You're listening to the Whole Hog Sports Podcast. And now, here's your host, Matt Jones.
Today on the show, Adam Cole from the Montgomery Advertiser will join us to talk about Auburn ahead of this week's game at Razorback Stadium. We'll also discuss the story about the Razorbacks not playing at War Memorial next year. First, a word from Kendall King.
4 decades of design. We're continuing the legacy of great creative design by combining our brands of Kendall King, Soapbox, and ShopCart. Together, these brands represent a new focus in marketing design, with individual attention to specific areas. Through our design expertise supported by a team of talented professionals, we showcase our best. We are Kendall King, we are Soapbox, we are ShopCart, we are design.
Adam Cole covers Auburn for the Montgomery Advertiser. He joins us now. Adam, what's the feeling down there on the plains about this game this weekend?
Man, it's a great question, Matt. I think it has been the same feeling it has felt like for the last few weeks, but it probably feels more real than ever that, you know, I think the excuse, the defense could be made that as far as Hugh Freeze's job security the last 4 weeks, you know, you're playing, I think all were top 12 teams at the time that you played them. And now, you know, no disrespect to Arkansas, but this is your first time not playing a ranked opponent in 4 games. And I think, you know, this is certainly the point where I think Auburn and Hugh Freeze in particular has to show that there's a difference, at least this time around. Otherwise, you know, we'll see what happens. But certainly there has been a lot of chatter about the man at the top and his job security. And if things don't go as Auburn would hope they do this weekend, I'll be very interested to see what comes from this if they can't pull out a win.
Well, you know, Auburn's never been the most patient bunch. I mean, Terry Bowden and Tommy Tuberville and Gus Malzahn all were very good coaches there, and they all got run out of town. And you know, we saw with Brian Harsin after Arkansas beat them a few years ago, he got let go the next day. How hot do you think the seat is for you?
It's really, like, I think it's undoubtedly hot. I think the question of just how hot is one that's a little more uncertain. Yesterday, he actually got asked about just kind of the statements Wisconsin and Florida State's ADs had put out about Fickell and Mike Norvell, and, you know, was asked if he would like that. And, you know, I think probably the simplest response would have been, you know, I'm not really worried about that. I'm worried about beating Arkansas. And instead he said, you know, gosh, that'd be great. Like, that would make everybody feel a lot better. And he also acknowledged the fact that him and John Cohen, the AD here, have not spoken since the loss to Missouri on Saturday, which, you know, I said this earlier after that was all said. But I mean, regardless of the context that may be missed in that, it certainly sends a signal that maybe there is a level of, okay, you know, Auburn's top brass is maybe trying to figure out what's next behind closed doors. And Hugh Freeze may not be in those meetings, so to speak. So I think the seat is certainly hot, and I think that with what's coming up the next few weeks, you go on the road, you play this Arkansas team, you come home, you play Kentucky, and then you go on the road to Vanderbilt before you head into an open week. And I think if Auburn loses either of its next 2 games, I think it's fair to say that Auburn feels like there's a good chance that a coaching change gets made, but we'll see. I think their MO usually is to try to wait as long as they can to make a move after a season, but push is coming to shove, so to speak. And I think these next 2 weeks, if Auburn can't find wins, I think we really could see some change.
It feels like to me, and I'd be curious to see if you agree, you know, obviously Arkansas has gone through its coaching change in the last few weeks. With so many teams that kind of got out front of this year, Virginia Tech and UCLA after week 3 and Oklahoma State after week 4, and now you got Arkansas and Penn State and Florida are open. It almost feels like with some of these ADs, there may be a pressure to say, hey, we got to get out there too, and we got to get on the market.
Yeah, I think that was my kind of immediate thought when Penn State decided to let James Franklin go. Because, I mean, inevitably, when a job of that stature opens in a cycle, I think it puts pressure on everybody else to make a move. And now Auburn finds itself in a place where, you know, even if, however wild the hypothetical may be, I mean, if Auburn manages to beat Arkansas, beat Kentucky, and get a little hot, and, you know, let's say they win out, or maybe they win, you know, every game but the Iron Bowl, suddenly you're faced with this, and the reality is, like, you know, maybe you find yourself maybe in a situation that Florida was in last year with Billy Napier of like, do you go back to him with the season ending on a high note, or now with the market the way it is and so open? I mean, do you still make a change in an effort to, you know, go out and try to court some of these guys who, you know, maybe are at smaller schools and would take a bigger job in this cycle who didn't last year? Or maybe you go out and, you know, I mean, James Franklin, I think, is an option that Auburn would certainly have to make a call about if they decided to move on from Hugh Freeze. And there is far from any guarantee that James Franklin is going to take a year off from coaching. And so, no, it definitely, it sets up this sort of, you know, everybody else is doing it, so we need to not even necessarily fall in line, but we need to capitalize on that as much as we can. And so it's a fascinating thing to try to look at from a 30,000 foot view, because there hasn't been a lot of definitive reporting on, hey, what's going on behind closed doors in Auburn. But I think there's inevitably a pressure that comes with all of the changes that are happening and the changes that could come at the end of the season, whether that is like a Florida State or a Wisconsin. That's two more, not just power four, but really power two jobs that are going to be filled by some very presumably capable coaches if those schools decide to go that route. So I think Auburn finds itself in a tough place, because, you know, you just suddenly have even more pressure to make a change if that's something that you're considering.
You know, Freeze is so good at Ole Miss. He had a really good run there at Liberty. He hasn't had a winning record at Auburn, and a caveat there is that they went 6-7 his first year and lost in a bowl game. But why do you think it hasn't worked out the way that people thought it would? Because I thought that he would go there and he would figure out a way to win.
I don't disagree with you. I thought, you know, kind of the elevator pitch for hiring Hugh Freeze was, okay, this is a guy who, you know, had some off-field troubles that led to his end at Ole Miss. And, you know, this notion of, okay, well, you know, the things that may be concerning are the off the field stuff, but you go back and you look at his track record and year over year, I think he's only had one sub 500, maybe two, in all three of his stops as an FBS head coach, including that year at Arkansas State. So I think the elevator pitch was, okay, yeah, we gotta make sure this guy's, you know, everything's fine off the field, but surely he's going to find a way to win on the field and maybe even win fast. And I think you go back and look at these last 3 years, I think the first two are something that got talked about a lot and maybe even got talked about a little more than they should have, to a point where it was excusatory of just where this roster was when Auburn moved on from Brian Harsin. I mean, that was a coach who did not really put much of an emphasis at all on recruiting. And, you know, it was a little bit before my time in Auburn, but my understanding is, and you look at some of the numbers, the back half of Gus Malzahn's tenure, the recruiting kind of took a downturn a little bit. It wasn't abysmal, but it wasn't what Auburn had been of these top, you know, consistently top 10, you know, top 15 kind of level recruiting classes. And so the first 2 years with all this discussion of talent gap, and, you know, we got to close the talent gap and it's going to take time. But I think this year has been a different story. And I think the talent gap is closed. And that's, when I look at this situation, that's the biggest thing that I look at is, you know, I know Jackson Arnold had his struggles at Oklahoma. There's no denying that. That shouldn't be not acknowledged. But like, this is a guy who was a consensus five-star prospect and, you know, had a high billing. Like, he wasn't that for no reason. You know, the same thing goes for, I really think, the two other best examples are Xavier Chaplin and Mason Murphy, your starting offensive tackles. Chaplin was one of the highest rated transfer recruits in the portal this offseason, and Murphy wasn't on that level, but he was a 2-3 year starter at USC, which is, you know, usually not for nothing. Like, the talent is here. There's also the bedrock of two top 10 recruiting classes behind them, guys like Cam Coleman. And so you have it all, but I think the common denominator in all of this is Hugh Freeze. And I think when you look at this team and specifically this offense that has struggled again for a third year with this overhaul, you look at just the game planning and the play calling, and it looked like for 1 week, maybe Hugh Freeze was going to kind of put his history of success and his reputation for success to the side when they beat Baylor, and they did it by running the heck out of the ball. Mm-hmm. And some of those things kept up through non-conference play. And then you go to Oklahoma and it's, you know, I think it was 13 handoffs to his running backs and somewhere between like 43 and 50 dropbacks. And that had not been the recipe for success up to that point. And there has just been a lot of that the last 4 weeks, especially those first two. There has been what has felt like a need to game plan, play call based on your reputation, your history of success, as opposed to the guys you have and what the game is giving you. And I think that is the thing that has caused Auburn to be where it is right now. The defense hasn't been gangbusters all out, but they've played winning football. They've executed for the most part in pretty crucial situations. They've certainly had their weaknesses, but they have given this offense a lot of opportunities, and the offense hasn't found success. And I think a lot of that to me goes back to, you know, the game planning and the play calling, and not really trying to be stubborn with running the ball and trying to force, you know, an explosive offense, when I think the personnel you have has shown that they find a lot of success with ground and pound, and there hasn't been a willingness to commit to it, be stubborn about it. And that's really, when I look at this year, that's the biggest struggle to this point, undoubtedly, to me.
Yeah, Auburn, they feel kind of like the inverse of Arkansas, in that Arkansas, you got this great offense and a terrible defense. And at Auburn, you, like you said, they've got a winning defense that's been paired with a really bad offense. Is it the offensive line? Or maybe put it a different way, how much does the offensive line play into what's going on there? Because every time that I've watched Auburn this year, it's been alarming, the number of sacks they've given up. It was like, what, 10 against Oklahoma? I think they had 5 last week against Missouri. It just seems like they're not able to protect Arnold in the slightest.
I think, you know, you can't – I think I'd be silly to sit here and tell you that there are not things that have needed to and should be improving on that offensive line. I think it was through the first 5 games, I think it was like 21 sacks surrendered, and wow, Auburn had, I think, like 34, 38 penalties. 17 of those were on the offensive line. You can't not go back and look at those things and see, you know, hey, do we need to make a personnel change, stuff like that. But at least, especially through those first 2 weeks, I think you've seen it in shades change the last 2 weeks. Auburn's come out early and looked really good on offense and just has not maintained it for 4 quarters, whether it was against Georgia or Missouri. But like, I kind of, again, go back to that overarching point, especially that Oklahoma and that A&M game, of like, when you don't try to establish it, I don't know what you expect your offensive line to do when defenses are going up against you and saying they handed the ball off 13 times to their rushers, you know, last weekend. And then against A&M, they handed it off 8 times to their running backs. I think defenses know that, like, you know, especially through those 2 weeks, it was like, this is a team that is not committed to its run game. We don't need to respect play action. We don't need to respect a guy back there standing next to Jackson Arnold. And they get to just pin their ears back and go to the quarterback, and they don't have to worry about rush lane integrity. And so, you know, I absolutely think some of it falls on the guys on the offensive line, but I have a hard time saying that, like, Hugh Freeze and this staff have really set them up to be successful. So it's a combination of the two, to, I guess, give a simple short answer.
So Arkansas's had its moment. It got rid of its head coach, and it feels like there's a lot of buy-in right now with the players, with Bobby Petrino. I wonder, when you've got Auburn, and, you know, we'll see what happens with Hugh Freeze, but maybe do they start hearing some of that noise, and does that affect how they play on the field this weekend?
I have wondered a lot about that, especially it was after the Georgia game. Damari Alston, team captain, came out, and Hugh Freeze said he'd been, he did not verbatim say dismissed, but he said that he had failed to, I think, live up to the standards and expectations of the program, was no longer with the program. And eventually, you know, some outlets have reported that it was, I think, kind of an NIL dispute, if you will, that, you know, Alston had played 4 games, hadn't really played a lot, and was kind of like, I think, came to the coaches and was like, you know, if you're up for it, I'd like to take a red shirt this year, still be around, still be contributing, but be able to come back and play again next year. And you know, eventually that was, I think it was a difference of opinion on how Damari Alston could contribute to this team. But I wondered what that would look like against Missouri. And I think you kind of had a similar performance from that team that it had the week before against Georgia. That came out, looked pretty decent, and then eventually you kind of get out of the scripted drives and things fall apart. And you know, you look at going into the overtime, everybody goes back to that clip of Zion Young on Missouri's defense, just talking throughout the coin toss for overtime, and Auburn's captains are just kind of standing there, And I think there's a maybe a lacking level of juice, if you will. And I'm sure some of that contributes to it. We have not heard that expressly from players and media availabilities. They've been pretty buttoned up in PR as far as that goes. I think they've been maybe even better about that sometimes than Hugh Freeze has been. But I think it's hard not to wonder if there is a level of quit going on. And I think, you know, I'll be intrigued to see what happens this weekend, just with kind of the circumstance of the game and what you look at on paper, and if maybe Auburn feels like it has a better chance because it's not going up against a Georgia or an A&M or an Oklahoma or even a Missouri. But I have no doubt that it's something that's weighing on these guys, even if it's something that they're not really saying is you know, contributing to the lack of success.
I watched a lot of the game against Georgia, got to see the last quarter against Missouri after I got home from covering the game here in Fayetteville. It just feels like that play at the goal line popped a balloon with this Auburn team. I mean, it's mm-hmm. weird. There was a moment like that here in Fayetteville a few years ago where KJ Jefferson dives for the goal line against Texas A&M, has the ball knocked out. They take it back for a touchdown, and the whole season just fell apart at that point. It's weird how one play like that, you can look back on it and in the, you know, maybe with a little bit of hindsight, say, man, it just felt like that was the turning point in the season.
Yeah, I think that was a fascinating thing to watch unfold. You know, because Auburn goes into half and they're still up a touchdown. Georgia went on a 99-yard drive and kicked a field goal at the end of it to mm-hmm. make it a one-score game, which sucks, but like it's pretty easy to I think go into the locker room and say, hey, like that was miserable, we're all pissed about it, but like you're up a touchdown, mm-hmm. go out there and do the same thing. And it just that obviously did not happen, and I felt like we saw throughout that game as it went on, and even with you know Kirby Smart, you know, clapping and that whole kind of debate. Like I think what I noticed most was that it never seemed like Hugh Freeze regained his composure from that. And I think, you know, people make the argument a lot of times, however much of a cliche it is, that like your players are an extension of your head coach. And I think like I look back at that and I think if Hugh Freeze had managed to, you know, get out his frustrations after the play, take a deep breath and kind of regroup and look ahead, like, you know, I don't know what would have happened, but I think Auburn probably would have been in a better place in that game. And, you know, I'll be curious to see how that play is looked back on, like moving forward. But it was certainly like the momentum shifter in that game. And, you know, for the weeks to come, I mean, who knows? Maybe it is something we look back on of, yeah, that's where the season went downhill. But I think to this point, through this four-game losing streak, there are a lot of moments, games, halves, drives that Auburn can look at as, yeah, that's kind of where it all went to pot. But it was a weird one. That was a really, really weird one.
Get you out of here on this, Adam. Switching gears to basketball real quick, with the coaching change down there, Bruce Pearl to Stephen Pearl, why did it take so long for that to materialize so close to the season? Like why was this something that Bruce Pearl had 6 months to make this announcement that he was going to step away and turn things over to his son? Why wait until right before the season begins?
That's a really good question. I've been curious about that myself. We've only gotten so many answers about it. And really, I mean, Stephen Pearl has been the one who has given a lot more, I guess, maybe substance to the timeline of all of this, because, you know, I mean, it was chatter throughout the offseason of, you know, I mean, is Bruce Pearl going to step down and run for Senate? Ultimately, he's not going to. But, you know, this decision was announced on the first day of Auburn's, you know, practices this year. And, you know, I mean, this is all speculative when I say this, but like, you know, I imagine there's a level of, okay, wait until that point, because, you know, this transfer portal window that opens, you know, suddenly these kids aren't in a place where your whole roster dissolves. But then there's also, you go back to the question of, you know, if that was going to happen, why didn't Auburn make this change after the Final Four and go from there? You know, I wonder about a lot of it myself. But at the end of the day, like, I think, you know, I've seen a lot of people understandably raise a very fair question about, you know, the nepotism of this hire. And I don't think that's something that people should just disregard or not question. But like, I do think too, like the best way that I have heard this put, because Auburn was going to be in a fascinating place, especially if the timeline of all of this was different, of, you know, you are what you are now. You're probably in a place now where you could entertain just about any candidate that you want to, even if you're not going to be able to get anybody you want, you could at least have that discussion with a lot of people, not a place you were before Bruce Pearl. Mm-hmm. But the best way that I have heard it put was this, and it's that I was talking to a friend about this, and he said to me, it always kind of seemed like Auburn basketball was more Bruce Pearl than Bruce Pearl was Auburn basketball. Not to say that the two aren't synonymous, but, you know, there's an inevitable dice roll of going with an outside hire, right? There's an inevitable dice roll with every hire, but I think the dice roll that you deal with in hiring Stephen Pearl is not equivalent to an outside hire. And that would have been, okay, we have established this, you know, again, cliche, but this culture, this system, this identity for the last decade plus under Bruce Pearl, and his son has been right there through it all. And his son has been, you know, involved in game strategizing, on court decisions. You know, he really is the guy who ran point on a lot of the transfer portal recruiting, you know, going back to like the Jabari Smith, Walker Kessler year. This is a guy who, as much as he is his predecessor's son, like I think he has learned a lot in this time. And I am very curious to see how it all goes. But like I will say that I think the most surprising outcome to me would be Auburn backsliding hard, and this dice roll inevitably is just, okay, this is the guy who doesn't have the head coaching experience. Is he going to fall in line with that? But he's got this entire roster that he helped recruit. He's got the same coaching staff that he's been working with for the last, you know, few years. Like it's all interesting, and I'm curious to see what the months to come bring up about all of this. But you know, that's really the biggest question that I have in all of this, is just the timing of it all, and why did it have to happen then, and why couldn't it have happened, you know, months in advance?
Adam, good stuff. Adam Cole of the Montgomery Advertiser. We'll see you Saturday up here at Razorback Stadium.
Awesome. Thanks, guys.
All right. Appreciate it, Adam. When we come back, Christina Long will join me in studio. First, a word from Kendall King.
At Kendall King, we're proud of over four decades of design. We're continuing the legacy of great creative design by combining our brands of Kendall King, Soapbox, and ShopCart. Together, these brands represent a new focus in marketing design, with individual attention to specific areas. Through our design expertise supported by a team of talented professionals, we showcase our best. We are Kendall King, we are Soapbox, we are ShopCart, we are design.
Welcome back. I want to tell you about our friends at Bentonville Glass. They've been serving their community since 1971. They're committed, professional, and versatile. If you're looking for a quality leader in Northwest Arkansas or looking for skilled craftsmanship, look no further than Bentonville Glass for all your glass market needs with the highest quality products. You can come by and see them now at 507 South Main in Bentonville or online at BentonvilleGlass.com. Christina Long is in studio with me now. There was a story this morning in the Democrat Gazette that basically, I don't know. I don't want to say there was no news value to this story, because I don't think that's true. But it was kind of framed as Arkansas is not going to change its 2026 football schedule to accommodate a story or to accommodate a game against Arkansas State at War Memorial Stadium. I didn't even think that was on the table. I mean, this everything in 2026 to me seems locked in. They're going to play 9 conference games. We already know who those opponents are going to be. They're going to play North Alabama and Fayetteville to start the season. They're going to play Tulsa next year, and they're going to play Utah at Utah. I didn't think any of that was changing next year. I've always thought that when it comes to War Memorial, if they go back there, which I think is a big if, and if they play Arkansas State there, that it would be several years down the road before they do this. Because in order to do that, you're going to have to pay out some team or buy out, you know, some games against teams, you know, and you're going to put them in a bind. You know, like if for instance, you cancel the Tulsa series next year, which is really the game that would have to go in order to accommodate Arkansas State, because you got to keep Utah to fill the Power Four requirement as a non-conference game. And they're not going to change North Alabama. We know they want to play an FCS game. So it'd be Tulsa that has to go. Well, you know, the buyout for that, kind of reading between the lines here, is going to be somewhere in the $2 to $3 million range. Plus, you leave Tulsa in a bind next year, where now they're less than a year away from the season started, and they got to find an opponent, and that's a big payday. You know, that payday for a group of five team or a group of six, whatever we're calling it, is a big deal when they're playing one of these power teams. And so I never felt like in 2026 this was going to change. And I would even go so far, and I've said this before, that I don't think it's going to change until after 2030 at the earliest, because that's when they've got their scheduling or they're scheduled out through is through 2030. So if they were going to play A-State at War Memorial every year on Thanksgiving, like the governor wants to see happen, but it would be 2031 before they could do that. So we'll start there. I to me, it was just like, I didn't really know that this was even something that was being considered, or if it was being considered.
Yeah, I mean, I think to me, this conclusion is basically like, well, yeah, duh, you know. And they, I think, I guess, and correct me if my understanding is wrong here, but I guess they kind of felt like they needed to look into it after the governor, you know, sent the letter. And then she sent the public letter, wrote the op-ed, whatever, and then probably also had additional, this is speculation, I don't know this, but probably also had additional conversations with athletic directors, administrators, things like that. And maybe those conversations, plus all of the kind of public posturing that she did about it, made them say, okay, we need to at least go through the motions of what this would look like. Honestly, probably to back up their case for why this would be a bad idea, which the conclusion that they reached is, yeah, it would be a bad idea. It would cost them about $9 million in terms of the revenue loss that you have from playing in Little Rock versus playing in Fayetteville, and then also buying out the Tulsa game, which it says would be about $2 million, it sounds like. So that
I've
would
heard
total,
it maybe even a little bit more
really,
than that.
They said the story here, which I wanted to, is by Ella McCarthy from the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, said the low end estimate, it was about $8.3 million, and the high end was about $10.3 million.
And I wanted to get into those numbers. So here's what I think they're saying. And these were numbers, by the way, that were come up with by Craig Teagues, who's the CFO for the Razorbacks, and Ed Fryer, who is one of the UA trustees. He's a, as they say in the story, a PhD trained economist. I don't think I'll ever reach that level of, of notoriety, but, what I think happened here is that they're looking at how much it would cost, how much they would lose by playing, by not playing in Fayetteville, buying out the game with Tulsa, what they would lose in terms of revenue, game day revenue here in Fayetteville. What this does not take into consideration, I don't think, is what kind of game day revenue they would get playing at War Memorial. We don't know what that game day revenue looks like, but you know, based on some numbers that are a little dated, but I think probably still kind of true, I would think a pack game at War Memorial would probably be $4 to $5 million. So you're still probably losing out on, you know, several million dollars by not playing in Fayetteville. You know, one of the things, one of the problems with War Memorial is that they just don't have the things that are baked into the War Memorial experience like they do on campus. On campus, there are so many levers that you can pull financially to make money over here. And make money. The biggest being that there's like 160 suites inside Razorback Stadium, not to mention all the other premium seating areas, north end zone, south end zone, indoor club, which sounds like a terrible experience sitting in an indoor club. I was watching them Saturday, and I was thinking this would be the one time that maybe that would be a good seat to have with all the rain coming
down. Honestly,
yeah. But you know, they're behind the glass. But
with how great that atmosphere was, like we talked about, they missed out on all
they've done so many things in the stadium, just from a premium seating perspective, to, like, you don't have any of that at War Memorial. You got very little of it, and I don't know that the university gets to retain any of that premium seating cost that they do have in War Memorial. Again, a very, you know, minuscule amount that they have there. But then there's all kinds of other things that they have in Fayetteville. They've got kiosks that have got their pro shops. They've got, you know, all these little, you know, alcohol stations that you can go. And I mean, and the list just goes on and on and on.
Don't they?
They know how to make money in their home stadium.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of limitations to being able to make money when you go down to a stadium that is not one that you control.
Don't they not get the concessions or parking revenue at War Memorial, or did I make that up?
I think that, I'm not sure how it is now. I know that there have been, you know, these contracts between the UA and War Memorial, they're constantly changing where, you know, sometimes or in the old days, they would pay like $75,000 in rent to pay to play there. And then they took the rental fee out, but they were going to pay rent to play their spring game there. And then the SEC said you can't play your spring game there because you don't play there two times a year. Mm. And
that's a weird rule.
Yeah, there's all kinds of it's.
What is the purpose of that?
I think it may be the Jim Harbaugh thing, actually, to be honest with you. Remember whenever he wanted to go have satellite campuses in Florida or Rome or something like that?
I forgot about that. That was crazy.
And so I think that that may be where that came from.
Totally forgot about that.
In the SEC. But Arkansas, they had a spring game down there in 18, and they were supposed to go back down there in 20. And a few weeks before the COVID shutdown, the SEC had actually emailed Arkansas and said, you can't have your spring game there anymore because of this, you know, 205.1 paragraph D /3 rule that we have in our rule book. But yeah, the whole War Memorial thing is just, it's a perplexing, it's a complicated, but I don't feel like it has to be such a complicated issue. Like it feels to me like, yes, it was a good thing whenever, like it served its purpose for Razorback football. Now you got to be able to move away from that.
The era, it is a bygone era. It is not helpful in this era. And you know, I think it's hard for me a little bit because I do think I get to a point, and I was kind of feeling this way this morning. I don't even remember what I was reading about, but there's a lot of days now, I feel like, where sometimes I just get very frustrated and I'm like, does everything in life, and some of this is like, is this just because I'm an adult now and it's always been this way? And just now that I'm grown, I know this.
The answer is yes.
Is everything just about money all the time?
A lot of times.
Every minute of every day, in every decision, all the time. Because it feels like it is. And so part of me, you know, I think the Little Rock game is a bad idea, in large part because of the financial aspect. But then at the same time, I'm kind of talking out of both sides of my mouth because at the same time, there's a lot of other things in college sports that I'm like, why should we? I hate that we're doing this thing just for money considerations. And I don't think the Little Rock thing is entirely money considerations, but it's mostly. And I think it's smart for them to do that. So it's hard. I think I'm of two minds about it because I understand and have a lot of respect for the people that are, you know, have grown up with this game, that like the Little Rock game, that want to be able to go to it. But at the same time, with the world that we're in, you kind of just have to maximize the financial part of this.
Yes, everything's about money. It is. I mean, even, you know, like I had an opportunity to do some outside work for something a week or so ago. And, you know, it's going to be a nice little payday for a few hours. But it was also the last night of my son's football season. Mm. And it was like, okay, do I go experience the last game or do I take the paycheck? Mm-hmm. And I went with the game. But the paycheck was a consideration. Yeah. You know what I mean? So, yeah, it's... Welcome to adulthood.
It's on a micro level and a macro level. It's just like everything. And it's hard because I feel like in sports, you know, a lot of times you want, and I've talked about this before, about how I wonder at what point college sports and things will reach kind of a breaking point with fans about, you know, people don't necessarily want to feel like they have to have a law degree or a PhD econ level knowledge of the workings of things to even just keep up with their favorite team. And I think it can be a little disheartening when sports is something that you want to just be able to have fun with and you want to kind of turn the rest of the world off and think about your favorite team, watch your favorite team, whatever. But you have to know about, you know, Saudi Arabia now. Like, it's just there's just so much going on that it's like it just kind of seeps into everything. And so sometimes I get very cynical and I'm like, God, nothing can just be fun.
7 million is the way I read this is 7 million is about the average game day revenue. They say that it looks like on the high end it would be maybe about 8 million in game day revenue. Maybe on the low end it'd be somewhere around 6 million in game day revenue. So you find the sweet spot there in the middle. But as of right now, and this isn't changing next year, and again, I don't think it's really that big of a surprise. Arkansas's not going to play at War Memorial next year. And again, I'd be very surprised if this changes anytime soon. That because I just think that the financially it does not make sense. And financially, more than ever before, finances are playing such a big role. I was having a conversation actually recently with Craig Teagues, who's the CFO who helped prepare this. And, you know, I think a lot of people think that the House settlement, okay, that's gone and that's all behind you and you're not having to pay attention to that anymore. I said, no. I said, like, this is the first year of kind of a 2-year storm that we have to weather with the House settlement. Mm. And, you know, so from a financial standpoint, for the people who, you know, are kind of down in the weeds and on the front lines, so to speak, like they're still very early in this House settlement and how it affects everything. And the more money you can free up, or maybe better said, the more money that you can bring in for your department, the easier it's going to be to weather this storm right now. So again, 2026 would be the second year of that 2-year storm for the house settlement. And like, and the other thing is, like, you never know what's on the horizon.
Yeah.
Like, nobody saw COVID on the horizon.
Yeah.
And that's still a battle that they're facing. I mean, the just the U of A, from an athletic standpoint, I think they're paying off something like $12 million a year for at least a couple of more years in COVID loans. The SEC gave all of the teams money to help, you know, offset the basically they didn't give them money, but what they did was they forward paid some of the conference distribution. And so you're getting like $4 million withheld per year until your cut of that COVID loan is paid back. Or in the U of A's case, they also took out a COVID loan that was refinanced through the university, and that's like another $4 million a year that they're trying to get paid back. And so once they get these COVID loans off the book, then all of a sudden, that's when, I think Hunter Yurchek said this at the trustees meeting last month, he said that's kind of the sweet spot where the Bud Walton Arena renovation might be able to occur. But again, what's on the horizon? I don't know that anybody knows.
What makes him say 2 years? Because I see this as not just something that's a 2-year. I see this as something that's going to be going on for a long time.
Yeah, it goes on for a long time. I think it's one of those deals where they're talking about it takes 2 years to kind of get everything normal.
Yeah, if that makes sense. Get your feet under you a little bit. Yeah.
So
that makes sense.
So no game at War Memorial Stadium next year. It'll just be the third time since War Memorial Stadium opened. Losing my voice right here, that Arkansas won't play down there. I'm talking about neutral sites, and I asked Adam about this earlier, but there's a story that Auburn is playing, I missed this a couple of weeks ago, but that Auburn's going to play Baylor in Atlanta in 2026, and they think that they're going to be able to make several million dollars from this game to give back to athletes through NIL funds. This is really fascinating to me, because, you know, like with Arkansas A&M, when they played at Arlington, you know, I don't know what the exact payout was. It was somewhere, I think, between $3.5 to $5 million a year to each school that they got for playing down there. And that just kind of goes back into the department's, you know, revenue pot. This is different because now, and this is creative, and I think there's going to be a lot of teams that are watching this to see how this works out and whether or not, hey, is this something that we should do? I thought the era of neutral site games was kind of behind us. You know, like there was a real spike, a real proliferation of neutral site games. And now I think that if this works, we might see that spike again.
I was listening to, I believe it was an episode of Split Zone Duo, which is a national podcast I like. I've referenced their work on here before because I just learn a lot from them, so I recommend them. When they talked about this on an episode when this kind of came out a couple of weeks ago, and they were kind of saying that this is something that maybe bowls might look at doing to kind of make bowl games a little bit more meaningful, you know, that that could be an option. Again, like you said, if this works. I'll be interested, I can't remember how many... There was some estimate about like how much NIL this could generate for these teams. It's not in this ESPN story. I'm not sure where it came from exactly.
I think it's mostly for Auburn. I don't know that Baylor gets an NIL cut out of this because Auburn, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but Auburn's getting like 21,000 tickets and Baylor's only getting 3.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know that the ticket distribution necessarily goes into the if there's a – if the cut that each team gets is based on their ticket distribution, but that part did stand out to me.
It says in the ESPN story, it says the Peach Bowl will provide opportunities for promotional appearances for Auburn players promoting ticket sales and ancillary events. Because again, don't forget, everything has to be legitimate NIL, valid business purpose. Mm. So they are not just going to, in theory, they're not going to just pay players to play in this game. They're going to pay them to advertise ticket sales for this game to Auburn fans who will want to come to Atlanta is the idea.
This took Auburn people or Auburn fans by surprise when they did this because I think that they had, and I don't know, I'm sure they probably haven't started selling their season tickets for next year, but this people thought that this was going to be part of their season ticket package next season.
Yeah, it's kind of a big deal for them. And I mean, it made me think a little bit of some of the frustrations that Arkansas fans have had with like the Little Rock game or the Arlington game, and you know, losing, you know, neutral site games can change a lot. And like you said, season tickets, and it changes what you're able to go to, obviously, with your home schedule. And so, yeah, I think it was kind of a mixed reaction there from Auburn people.
Maybe Arlington becomes a thing for Arkansas again. I don't know. I don't think Arkansas A&M's moving
rule it
to
out.
Arlington.
Yeah, I wouldn't rule it out. If something like this becomes more commonplace, that would be an easy thing.
It just, college sports are such a copycat thing right now, mm-hmm. where like if it works for somebody, we're going to see if it can work for us. Mm-hmm. That I feel like there are going to be a lot of eyes on this to see, hey, is this something that we can? And with Auburn, I mean, the maybe quick nature with which they've been able to turn this around, it's not necessarily a thing where you have to schedule 4 years in advance like they've done, or 5 years like they've done with the Las Vegas game. Maybe.
Yeah, I already forgot that's happening.
And do some of the neutral site games that are already scheduled long term, like Arkansas, Texas Tech in Las Vegas, do they have to pivot to a model where, you know, they see what's going on for the other sites that are doing these things?
Yeah, does it become something where schools expect it or ask for it more often? And so then you kind of have to be attractive, you have to do that. It's interesting how things like this. I was talking to somebody a long time ago about, you know, all of these different kind of college athletics maneuvers, and they were saying nobody ever wants to be first. Schools are always looking at examples of what other schools are doing, but mm-hmm. it does take someone to be first. Mm-hmm. And this would be interesting if it works.
I think it's fascinating. And my first thought, like I said, whenever I read that was, does Arkansas get back into bed, so to speak, with the Cowboys and AT&T Stadium?
I don't think it would take much. Yeah, I think it would be an easy option. If this becomes more commonplace, it would be an easy option.
And like the Joneses, they've said that they can't contribute to NIL.
Right.
That was something that was asked of Stephen Jones on the radio in Dallas 2 or 3 years ago. Basically, somebody said, you know, do you ever think about just tipping the scales in favor of the Razorbacks? And he said, you know, the NFL, they frown upon that. We've got rules that would keep that from happening. But this is a way that this is an area where they do have some influence without mm-hmm. directly having.
Right. This would be, again, that valid business purpose. This would be, in theory, or at least what they say is, yeah, this would be a business transaction.
Real quick, before we get out of here, Bobby Petrino spoke yesterday. Anything that you took out of his press conference?
It was kind of what we expected to hear. You know, he said a lot of the same stuff that he had said post-game about, you know, they're playing with more effort. He likes the way that they're running to the ball better, especially defensively, but just they have to do more. So I think, you know, he talked a little bit about how Auburn's offense presents an opportunity for this defense, just with, like we talked about yesterday, the struggles that Auburn's offense has had, and how this is probably going to be the worst offense they've played in a while, definitely in conference play or since they've been playing Power 4 teams. I think this is definitely an opportunity for them. He talked a little bit about how just he continues to be impressed with the way that they've been able to kind of come together here, even in what is a lost season. Mm-hmm. My words, not his. But I think those were kind of the main takeaways. You know, the thinness on the defensive line remains a concern. He talked about, you know, how they've had to use guys like Frank Mulapola and Caleb James, who we saw play some meaningful snaps the other day, which was like, I realized, I can't remember partway through the game. I was like, Ethan, Caleb James is on the field. He's like, yeah, he's been on the field. I was like, huh? So there's a lot going on there on the defensive front. And he talked a little bit about some of that and just how that affects what they're able to do.
Arkansas and Auburn coming up Saturday, 11:45. Forecast does not look good again. I know Christine is excited
about this. I'm supposed to have a Halloween party that night. What am I going to do?
Well, maybe it's not thunderstorms. Maybe it's just rain.
That would be ideal.
Yeah.
But isn't it thunderstorms?
I don't know.
We'll see.
I don't know.
I'm scared.
It's so far out that it's...
I know.
Who knows? This stuff can change quicker than even college athletics, the weather can. Christina, appreciate you being here. Christina's going to be in this chair tomorrow hosting the show. Hope that you'll tune in then or visit us at wholehogsports.com. We'll see you then. Have a great day, everybody.